This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. At the founding of the U.S., the right to vote belonged to a privileged few. White, male, property owners were the only people directly steering the fate of this nation. It took significant struggles to change that. The Civil War, women's suffrage, and the Civil Rights Movement were just pieces of the complex web of events that gave most adult U.S. citizens the right to vote.
But progress is not always linear. Over the past two decades, there have been significant efforts to suppress the voting population. Gerrymandering, restrictive voter ID laws, and purged voter rolls have all led to the disenfranchisement of many citizens.
One Person, No Vote chronicles the history of voter suppression in the U.S. and the ways that modern politicians are trying to suppress the vote in states throughout the country. Wisconsin plays a starring role in the book.
Carol Anderson is the author, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers by phone. She discusses the history of voter suppression after the passage of the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed all men the right to vote regardless of race.
It started with Mississippi in 1890, where Mississippi had to figure out, how do we suppress the black vote and still stay on this side of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that the right to vote shall not be abridged because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So how do you say you don't want black folks to vote, but you don't want black folks to vote? And what Mississippi figured out, and then it was adopted by a number of states in the South, was to go after the societally imposed characteristics on African Americans and use that as the litmus test to the ballot. And also cloak this in language that sounded very reasonable. So, for instance, when it came to the literacy test was one of the devices in the 1890 Mississippi plan. What the legislators said was, you know, we really want to have people voting who really know what our laws are, who understand what our legal conditions are, our legal frameworks are, who understand, you know, what our rules are. And so it just seems logical that what we would do is to just have them read, a section of the Constitution. And that almost sounds logical, except what Mississippi and other states had already been doing was to systematically underfund schools where African-American children went in proportion to white schools. And the effects were devastating. Early on, we saw the effects. By the time, though, we get to 1940, the NAACP has figured out that these states provide, on average, and these states being the states of the old Confederacy, provided on average 252% more funding for white schools than black schools. In Mississippi, the differential was 751%. And in many of these school systems, there were no high schools for black children. And so we take those societally imposed conditions and then we say, okay, now read the Constitution to the liking of the registrar. It was designed for people to fail. Same with the poll tax. The poll tax went after the conditions of endemic poverty, born out of centuries of slavery, and then coming out of the Civil War with no kinds of compensation, no 40 acres, moving into sharecropping, poverty. And then saying, well, you know, democracy's expensive. And, you know, when we're holding these elections, and we've got to have places where people are voting, and we've got to have paper for them to vote on, and we've got to have somebody collecting the votes and somebody counting the votes, all of that costs. So it's just logical that people who are really invested in our democracy would be willing to pay a small tax in order to keep our elections vibrant. Except for people who are endemically poor, that tax is a barrier too high. And then they crafted additional rules that made it unclear when you were supposed to pay the tax, how you were supposed to pay the tax, and where you were supposed to pay the tax. You just knew it was months ahead of the election. Months ahead, by the way, if you're a sharecropper who does not have cash because you don't get cash until the harvest comes in, means you don't have the money to pay the poll tax. And the poll tax was also cumulative. So there were all of these components built in that just clamped down on people's access to the ballot box, did so by looking at the kinds of societally imposed conditions that had a massive disparate impact on African Americans, and wrote the laws in such a way, though, that both the literacy test and the poll tax withstood a constitutional challenge and were found to be not in violation of the 15th Amendment by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, in looking at the voter suppression laws that we're seeing today and that we've seen over the last couple decades, similarly, they are written with race-neutral language, but their impact has been predictably racist. Looking at Wisconsin and these kinds of voter suppression laws and regulations, what do we see here?
Whew. You know, there are a couple of ground zeros for this, and Wisconsin, unfortunately, is one of them. So what we have happening in Wisconsin, I'll deal with gerrymandering first. So what happened there is after the 2010 election and the Republicans came to power, a handful of them then sequestered themselves away in a hotel room with a computer and powerful mapping software that allowed them to redraw the districts, for the congressional and legislative districts. Now, that's what the Constitution requires, is that after every 10 years, you know, there's a census and populations move and shift, and you wanted to have these legislative districts reflect those shifts in population. But that was just the cover, because the goal was twofold. One was to remove or eliminate as many competitive districts as possible. What that does is that it begins to depress voter turnout, because if you already know who's going to win, then why should I go vote? So-and-so is going to be there forever kind of deal. The second component was to ensure that no matter how many votes the Republicans received, that they would always have the majority of seats and thus the majority of power in the legislature. Now, that sounds in a democracy like, well, that's how it worked. Democrats were not allowed to be involved in any of the redistricting process. The Republicans who were not in that room had to sign non-disclosure agreements, and that was only to see their district alone. In the 2012 election, those maps worked out better than the Republicans could have even hoped for. Democrats received 52% of the vote, but only 39% of the seats in the legislature.
Yeah.
And the subsequent elections, it was worse.
So we have, of course, the legal challenge, which I think a lot of our audience is probably fairly aware of, Gil v. Whitford, which goes to the Supreme Court. We, of course, have now gotten that ruling, and they didn't quite rule for the state, but they didn't quite rule against them. And what I found interesting about that ruling is, in some ways, it does mirror what happened with the Civil Rights Act in general, in that there was sort of protections for voters, but, you know, as you state in the book, you have to go through this long process of now proving in each district that the vote was intentionally suppressed.
Right. So the genesis of a lot of what we're dealing with now has been the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in 2013 and the Shelby County v. Holder decision. And why the Voting Rights Act was so important is that it flipped on its head what had been tried over and over and over to recognize American citizens' right to vote. And one of the the big iterations of that was the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which was the first civil rights legislation passed since Reconstruction. And what that was designed to do, or supposed to do, was to deal with the systematic disfranchisement of black voters. But it required massive litigation, and so there had to be a voting rights violation first. And then the person whose rights were violated had to sue. So imagine you're in Mississippi. You're a black Mississippian, and you're suing a white official in Mississippi for violating your voting rights. And then you have to wait for an investigation. Then you have to wait for the trial. After the trial, there's the verdict, and then there's an appeal. Through that time, years have gone by. There have been multiple elections since the first one where you had been disfranchised. Meanwhile, the politicians and their appointees are in power, crafting additional rules and laws predicated on maintaining that power via disfranchisement. And oftentimes, the cases would come back, dropped, moot, et cetera. It didn't work. The Voting Rights Act said, we're not going to put the responsibility for proving these violations on American citizens. Instead, the states have the responsibility to honor the right to vote. And so states that have a history of discriminating against their voting population. And so they have fewer than 50% of their age-eligible adults registered to vote. And they have used one of these devices, a poll tax, a literacy test. Those jurisdictions, those states will come under preclearance, which means that any changes they want to make to their voting laws have to be okayed by the U.S. Department of Justice first, or the federal court in D.C. before they can be implemented, by requiring that they have to be vetted before they can be implemented. It stops the violations from happening. The Voting Rights Act worked. It was a thing of beauty in so many different ways, and how effective it was in opening up the franchise.
Of course, Wisconsin wasn't under preclearance, but post the ruling in 2013, and even before then, the state had already started to enact a lot of these new forms of voter suppression. So we look back before the Voter Rights Act, and we're talking about poll taxes, we're talking about the literacy tests. When we come to kind of the last decade, the last couple decades, we're looking at more voter purges, which haven't been quite as big in Wisconsin, but the closing of polling stations, which has been an issue, and voter ID, which has had a very big impact on suppressing the vote here in Wisconsin. Can you kind of get into voter ID and kind of where that comes from? Because Milwaukee was even a part of the birth of the idea that there were bad voters out there. There were people, you know.
Right. And I trace it to the 2000 election. And we often think of that 2000 election as the hanging chads and butterfly ballots and all of the problems, massive purges that happened in Florida. But it was in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri. And what happened there was that the St. Louis Board of Elections illegally purged nearly 50,000 voters off the rolls shortly before the election and didn't tell them. And so people go to vote, and their names aren't on the rolls. And the poll workers can't get through to downtown to figure out what's going on. So they just send the people. They start sending people downtown to get it all worked out. And it is taking hours and hours, and this is on a Tuesday, a work day, hours to get it all straightened out. The polls are getting ready to close. The polls are going to close at 7 o'clock, and people are still downtown at the Board of Elections. And so the Democrats sue, and they get a judge to order that the polls stay open until 10 o'clock to give people three additional hours, given all the time that they have wasted because of this illegal purge. Shortly thereafter, the Republicans countersued, And a higher judge ordered the polls closed immediately. So the polls were closed at 7:45. Now, what the Republicans said was that trying to keep the polls open past 7 o'clock was one of the most brazen, shocking attempts at massive voter fraud that they had ever witnessed. That this was an attempt to have people who were using addresses from all of the vacant lots around St. Louis, voting over and over and over and over, and having dead people on the voter rolls and having dogs on the voter rolls. This was nothing but rampant voter fraud, trying to steal an election. That language of massive, rampant voter fraud, U.S. Senator from Missouri, Kit Bond, who had been the one making these claims during the 2000 election, then carried that framework into Congress, where he helped shepherd through the Help America Vote Act. And that act was designed to deal with the reality of all that had gone wrong in Florida. Kit Bond insisted on inserting in there the lie of massive rampant voter fraud that could only be stemmed by voter ID. And so you have the reality of voter suppression being tied to the myth of voter fraud, and both being embedded in federal law, giving the lie substance, credence. And then you had an organization, the American Center for Voting Rights. It sounds so, wow, yeah, but it actually was a Potemkin village, like a Hollywood sound set. And it was a Republican effort to get the lie of voter fraud out there in so many venues until it became truth, which it did. And one of the things that they did was they basically had almost like, I want to call it like almost like an FBI most wanted list of the hot spots of rampant voter fraud in America. And Milwaukee was on that list, as was Cleveland and St. Louis and East St. Louis, Philadelphia. And it was a way to signal that voter fraud happened in the cities, and that the people in the cities were stealing elections, that you had this kind of massive, organized criminal activity happening that was undermining democracy. And given the way that cities and crime and people who live in the cities, which would, in the kind of psychological leaps, become African Americans, it was not too big a leap. In the cities on the American Center for Voting Rights list, the cities had a population range for minorities that went from 32% to 95%. It became clear how effective the lie of voter fraud was. There was a poll that showed that 50% of Americans believe that voter fraud really happens, that it's a real thing, that it happens at least occasionally. It happens, for 50%, it happens on a regular basis, and 70% believe that it happens occasionally. Wow. The work had been done. And so you have the lie of voter fraud, which has democracy in peril, being undermined by these people stealing elections. You have this being said by respectable people, you know, U.S. senators and secretaries of state and Ivy League educated attorneys. And then you have what sounds like a reasonable way to stop this kind of villainy, which is just requiring an ID when people vote. That framing sounds so reasonable. It sounds as reasonable as why we needed a literacy test or why we needed a poll tax. And it is equally lethal and disingenuous. Justin Levitt, a law professor out of California, did a study where he found that from 2000 to 2014, there were 1 billion votes cast in the United States, and only 31 of those could qualify as some kind of voter impersonation fraud, if something happened that way. Only 31 out of 1 billion. But that's not the narrative we get.
Well, and it's interesting that it's framed as an issue in the cities, especially with the dynamics that are at play with Milwaukee and really the rest of the state of Wisconsin. Sometimes when we hear politicians talking about Milwaukee at the state level, there is this kind of coded language that they use when they're talking about the city and what happens there.
Mm-hmm. And that coded language, I mean, that is vintage Southern strategy playbook. We must have law and order, we have crime, we have welfare cheats, and all of that is embedded in the city. It is the kind of criminalization of blackness that actually predates significantly the Southern strategy, but it is part and parcel of the ways that policymakers and people are able to create a problem child. You know, everything would be fine in our state except for. So what are we going to do? You know, I think about in The Sound of Music, how do we solve a problem like Maria?
Like Maria.
Right?
Yeah,
how do you solve a problem like Milwaukee? Right? Because that's the way that these areas are always viewed, in a deficit model, in a criminalized model, and not in terms of the incredible strength, resilience that people have there and the gifts and the abilities. Instead, it's the problem.
Now, when it came to Gilvey Whitford, when it came to gerrymandering specifically, the state of Wisconsin argued that this had nothing to do with race, that it was much more about party. And that, you know, the Democrats lost and the Republicans won, and so they get to choose how the maps are drawn. But can we separate the two?
And that's where that fiction happens, because the Supreme Court over time has ruled that cases that involve race require the highest standard of review, which is strict scrutiny. And so when you have racial gerrymandering, that requires strict scrutiny by the Supreme Court to ensure that this does not have a racial impact. Partisan gerrymandering has had a different course, to the point where in 1986, they're like, okay, there's something that's happening here. We don't know what it is, but it doesn't quite look right. And so by the time they get to the 2004 decision coming out of Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court punts again, but Justice Anthony Kennedy says, okay, this still doesn't look right, but once we're able to come up with some kind of formula that can discern whether extreme partisan gerrymandering actually exists, then maybe we can take a look at it then, because then there will be a judicial standard that we can use. Now, part of the problem in trying to do that kind of legal separation is that it's an act of fiction, because the parties have very different demographic makeups. You know, I talked about the Southern strategy, which emerged from the Republicans out of the civil rights movement, as the Southern Democrats were just like, oh, we can't stay here in the Democratic Party. There's no place for us here. I mean, my God, they've got planks talking about, you know, civil rights, and that African Americans have rights and that they're citizens and that they're equal. What are we going to do? And the Republicans were like, oh, come, welcome, welcome, welcome. The Republicans brought that toxin into the party, and eventually that toxin took over. To the party moved further and further to the right, and its policies became much more virulent, anti-black, anti-immigrant, anti. And the party demographics are almost 90% of the Republican Party is comprised of whites, whereas a bit over 50% of the Democratic Party is comprised of whites. So you have much greater diversity in the Democratic Party. And the Republicans' policies are anathema to the growing diversity, not only in the Democratic Party, but the growing diversity of America. America is becoming more diverse. And so it becomes harder and harder when you have right-wing policies to resonate with a population that is much more diverse, broad, and thinks more in terms of social justice issues, thinks more in terms of civil rights issues. And so the Republicans were like, ooh, they figured out that demographics are not destiny. What you have to do is you target the demographics that aren't going to vote for you, and you suppress that vote as much as possible. Paul Weyrich, who is one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation, and who also founded ALEC, which is the organization that provided the blueprint for these voter suppression laws for many of the state legislatures, was clear. He said, I don't want everybody to vote. And frankly, our leverage goes up as the voting population goes down. And that is the blueprint. And it really came into place after Obama's election in 2008.
It's interesting when you look at all of this, how explicit so many people, specifically in the Republican Party, have been about hoping to suppress the vote in different ways. I read a book, Rat Effed, I can't say the full title, by David Daley, which looks at the issue of gerrymandering. And in a lot of it, the GOP strategist said, you know, we want to crack and pack the districts. We want to make sure that, as you mentioned before, there aren't competitive districts. Some of the more pernicious things that you mentioned in your book that I didn't even quite think of before are things like lines at the DMV, or often where the DMV is located and whether or not there's one in the area. What are some of these, maybe, I don't know if sly is the right word, but kind of undercover ways in which the vote is effectively being suppressed?
And I love that you didn't even think about that. That means your mind never goes to the dark side. I'm going to deal with two things. One is that first you require, say, a driver's license to vote. That is almost like the holy grail of ID. And then what states like Alabama have done is to shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles in the Black Belt counties. And those are the counties that have sizable black populations in Alabama. And Governor Bentley didn't shut them down because he said, I don't want black people to vote, because that's a little too obvious. So he said, we've got to balance our state budget. We've got to be fiscally conservative. These Department of Motor Vehicles, we've done an analysis. We're not seeing a number of people coming through to justify the operating cost. And so in order to be fiscally responsible, we're going to shut them down. Well, what shutting down those Department of Motor Vehicles did was to then require residents in those counties to go about 50 miles to the nearest Department of Motor Vehicles to get a driver's license. But if you don't have a driver's license, how do you drive 50 miles? So, but you create an obstacle, and then you create an obstacle to the obstacle. Texas did the same thing. Texas realized that one-third of its counties did not have a Department of Motor Vehicles, and that they were going to have a number of residents who are going to have to make a 250-mile round trip in order to get a driver's license. And there's not public transportation available. And so at first, not at first, but during the drafting of their law, SB 14, they had language in there that would provide for reimbursement for residents who had to go to make that round trip to get the driver's license. Before they passed that law, they drew a red line through the reimbursement. So people are going to have to bear out of their own pockets the expense of a 250-mile round trip to get the driver's license. But again, you don't drive. How are you going to get there?
Do you see people in Wisconsin, throughout the country, trying to combat these voter suppression laws in some ways?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where my hope is. One of the things that strikes me about Americans in general is that you know, basically we're like, yeah, I got so much to do, yeah. And then when somebody starts messing with us, when we're figuring out that our rights are being systematically denied, we fight back. And that's why I have that chapter in the book, The Resistance, dealing with the election in Alabama with Roy Moore and Doug Jones. Because there you saw the people standing up and fighting back, overcoming all of those voter suppression techniques that the state of Alabama had deployed against them, ensuring that they got to the ballot box and ensuring that there would be no Senator Roy Moore. A lot of that work was done by civil society, and I see their activism, and I see local community groups doing things like, are you registered to vote? Are you registered to vote? Are you registered to vote? Okay, who needs a ride to the polls? Who needs a ride to the polls? Because when you shut down the polls in neighborhoods, the distance makes it difficult to be able to vote. So the getting people to the polls, I see activists who are working to elect people who believe in the franchise and not people who believe in suppression. We've got people in power who believe that voter suppression is the way to go. If those people aren't in power, then we're having very different laws. So I see places like Oregon. Oregon has one of the highest voter turnout rates in the nation. And Oregon wasn't satisfied. And so Oregon said, how can we get more of our people engaged? So they instituted automatic voter registration. People who have dealings with the Department of Motor Vehicles, they're automatically registered to vote. They have to say, no, I don't want to be registered, in order to come off the rolls. In the next election after that, their voter turnout rate actually increased, and the diversity of their electorate increased as well. California picked that up and added 16 and 17-year-olds to pre-register to vote. So I'm seeing this spread across the nation. That's where the hope is.
Yeah. Well, Carol Anderson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Carol Anderson is the author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. She's in town for an event at the Shorewood Public Library at 6:30 tonight. Carol spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. There is an extended version of their conversation at WUWM.com.